There's this thing that happens to me in September, like it or not, where I feel like the year is really starting. Bear in mind that I've been out of school for almost 20 years. But still, this month has that back to work, back to books, back to regular life quality that's both motivating and at times a little deflating because summer's over. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And I'm back on the show after some time on the road for a reporting project that you'll hear later this fall. This week, we've got some new school year stories for you, from for-profit colleges shutting down to Apple's fall product rollout, plus a book about how to do everything, whether it's at work, school, or home, smarter, faster, and better. As always, come share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. We're starting off, as we often do, with our segment Long and Short. That's when we look at the news using the language of finance. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. This week we have LA Times Assistant Business Editor Andrea Chang and Marketplace's own Rima Kreis. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Lizzie.
Hey.
It's nice to have you guys on the show this week. I'm going to start, going to break the format up a little bit. Andrea, your short has been in the news a lot this week. It's also something that we should say we've been reporting on. Marketplace is working on a collaboration with PBS about student debt. So why don't you tell us about your short?
My short this week is for-profit colleges, and that is because ITT Tech abruptly shut its doors earlier this week, shutting down 130 campuses across 38 states, affecting some 40,000 students. It's pretty dramatic. But, you know, this is an industry that has been suffering for a really long time. Last year, we saw Corinthian colleges shut down. So, yeah, I'm not too positive on for-profit colleges.
42 million people hold student debt. We're talking about some $1.3 trillion. A lot of that debt has grown along with the rise of for-profits. And it would be wrong of us to paint all for-profits with the same brush, but they tend to come with a higher price tag than, say, a community college or some local schools. And people have gotten themselves in a lot of trouble. And that seems to be something that's concerning the federal government.
Yeah, I think the federal government is upset about a number of issues related to for-profit schools. I mean, one of them has to do with really aggressive recruiting practices. And then the other thing is they're not really convinced that the schools are teaching the students what they need to know in order to succeed in the real world.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy when you think about it, too, because I feel like this was a business at one point that was really booming. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, there was a time where investors were just like swarming to this area. But like you said, I think it's built on these loans and it makes you wonder just how sustainable the model is. And I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing them essentially disintegrate.
Right. And yeah. I think it's a shame for the students, you know, who are really caught off guard by this. And, you know, 40,000 students, 8,000 employees, it's a lot of people who
A lot of people.
Yeah, who have to figure out something else to do and don't know what's going to happen to their loans and what their next steps are.
All right, I'm going to shift us a little bit from a short to a long. Rima, I want you to throw out your long for us.
My long is about meal delivery kits. Do y'all know what that is?
So. Yes, yes. They inundate my Instagram feed with ads. Tell us more.
Yeah. So they're the nicely packaged meals that arrive at your doorstep in cardboard boxes that have all the ingredients you want or need, rather, for a dinner. And it comes with like an idiot-proof recipe card so you can feel like you're the most amazing chef ever. But I bring it up because this week Hershey's announced a partnership with Cheft, which is a meal kit delivery service, so you can get s'mores delivered to your house or so you can build them. But I admittedly have never used them before, but I think they're going to grow. And I think it's because, you know, they've already been growing. I think there's some estimations that can be like a $5 billion industry in the next decade or so. There are like dozens and dozens of companies in this space. But I think the value in it is that they're also selling an experience and not just dinner. And I think in this age where we want convenience and we want to feel accomplished, this is where it's going to really, I think it's going to take off for that reason.
You know, you're absolutely right talking about that sweet spot. I mean, we've had multiple people on our show talking about how spending on experience is a valuable thing. And this is a really clever business in that it is both, you know, a meal, but also you have this moment where you feel like, oh, I'm a good cook.
I can do something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've done Plated. I haven't done Blue Apron, which I think is, you know, one of the two probably most popular ones.
Mm-hmm.
I've enjoyed it for sure, and it is a nice experience. But sometimes, like, the promise of just 20 minutes, and then you'll have, like, a home-cooked dinner. I mean, sometimes, like, an hour later, I'm, like, chopping up some, like, carrots and thinking, oh, my God, this would have been so much faster to just pick something up at, like, a fast food place.
Let's stay with food. Andrea, you've got a long for us that is also in the food world.
It is. So my long this week and every week is Chipotle. But there's actually a news peg this time around, which is on Tuesday, Bill Ackman announced that he had taken a 9.9% stake in Chipotle, which, you know, immediately sent the stock up quite a bit the next day. And this is because, you know, Chipotle has been just inundated with all sorts of health scares last year.
Yep.
And it's been taking a really long time for them to recover from it. So sales, profit completely plummeted, which is kind of crazy when you think about how quickly Chipotle expanded and how big a deal they were just a couple of years ago. So, you know, to make up for that, Chipotle has been flooding mailboxes with, like, free burrito offers and everything, which I have been taking advantage of. But
and so, for our listeners who don't know Ackman, he's an activist investor, mm-hmm. runs a prominent hedge fund. The market seemed to look at this and say, oh, yay, we like this.
The market did seem to like – so the very next day, which was Wednesday, they I think Chipotle stock was up about 6%, which was obviously significant. For consumers, you know, when you hear hundreds of people were sickened by, you know, food illnesses, it's hard to get people back in.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing that.
Yeah, I always feel like people forget, but they don't seem to be they haven't forgotten in this case, though. You know, like you
Indeed.
Said, they've been throwing free burritos at them and they're still not coming back. Yeah, I mean, I can't really imagine a world without Chipotle, but I don't know. I feel like it's facing a lot of competition in the fast casual arena. And there are lots of restaurants now that are claiming that they have the freshest ingredients and they can do it quickly and in an affordable way. So I don't know. I don't know if Chipotle will still be Chipotle.
All right, Rima, what are you short on? This one kind of depresses me.
I feel like such a Debbie Downer. So my short is on travel to Cuba. And I chose that because there have been all these headlines, right, in the last week or so about how airlines are now going to, or how they are sending over passenger commercial flights
yeah.
to the island, which is great. You know, like, symbolically, politically, it's a big deal. But I don't know. I just feel like there's a lot of hype around it and maybe not enough awareness or recognition about the obstacles and problems that I think airlines and passengers will face. I mean, I just don't know if Cuba's ready for prime time.
But it was featured on the Kardashians.
Right. So it definitely is, right? Right. It has to be. No, but I think that the island, for example, reportedly has fewer than like 70,000 hotel rooms. This is the first time that we're going to fly passenger flights in like more than 50 years. So restarting that is not an easy thing. The airport infrastructure is not completely there in terms of having compatible systems with carriers. U.S. wireless devices don't work there. U.S. credit cards. You know, I think there are a lot of eager and wide-eyed people who want to see the island, but I don't think that we're going to see a lot of travel there initially.
I think you're absolutely right when you think about the kind of infrastructure that is necessary to support a big tourism business. I was in Cuba in 2002, and you're right. We paid in cash. We stayed in a Dutch hotel. Anyone listening, I was there legally, just to be clear. But there are many, many, many miles to go before those companies and, you know, various entities can support a really thriving tourist business. That includes American business, because there are obviously tourists from the rest of the world who are there now.
Yeah, I think so.
Marketplace's Rima Crace, Andrea Chang from the LA Times. Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
All week, Marketplace has been observing the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. Here in New York City, the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum, a converted aircraft carrier, is celebrating with an exhibit called Star Trek, the Starfleet Academy Experience. Inside, there are different interactive stations, as well as costumes and props from the shows. Marketplace's Levi Sharp, who, it should be noted, will soon be getting a Star Trek tattoo, went there to collect some sounds and voices.
Hello. Welcome to Starfleet Academy. Live long and prosper.
Right now, I'm taking the medical sort of exam thing, I guess, and I'm supposed to be scanning the Klingon.
So it's warning you his blood oxygen is low and his pulse is irregular. So now, based on your findings, what are you going to diagnose this patient as having? You have a choice between osteoporosis,
not a
phaser wound, or a leaking heart valve.
I would say the leaking heart valve.
Okay, so click that.
Woo!
Yay!
I got it right.
Hello, I'm Blakeman. Your language instructor for today.
I think I'm learning Klingon here. He looks a little like Usain Bolt wearing a wig and ridges of his skull, obviously, which is what Klingons have.
Hob, Sisley, Cooch. Now you try.
Hob, Sisley, Cooch.
Tabla. Well done.
Well, Mrs. Havoc, are you going to stay with the sinking ship?
Oh, my God. Captain Kirk, come to me, baby.
I was transported. Touched a screen, and then there's this swirling line, like a funnel, that kind of takes you away and transports you away, and then you disappear. Your image disappears. When we first saw Star Trek, the original, the situation was very bad in America. But to see Uhura, that black people are still in the 25th century or whatever, and to see a Vulcan, someone very different, and how everyone got along, that was really uplifting. And that's what I've always liked about the show, its diversity and its ray of hope for humanity.
Mayday, mayday. This is Captain Kajiro Vance on the Kobayashi Maru. We've struck a gravitic mine and lost all power. We have 300 people on board, requesting immediate assistance.
This is the deck, and I'm sitting in the captain's chair right now. It feels very powerful.
I feel very responsible of the ship, and older, I guess. I think I'll watch it when I get home.
For more of our look at Star Trek's 50th, go to marketplace.org. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Case in point, where one of the biggest companies in the U.S. economy, Apple, meets an audience of consumers to show off its new stuff. Apple unveiled that stuff at its annual celebration of itself this week. And to talk about it, we've got Marketplace host and senior tech correspondent Molly Wood. All right, Molly, what did we learn this week?
We learned that Apple is still willing to take large risks with its phone buying audience, which is something that it's done before. The basics, just the facts, are that Apple unveiled its next version of the iPhone, the iPhone 7, and also its next version of the Watch, the Apple Watch 2. But the big controversy coming out of that announcement was that, as had been rumored, much to the disbelief of many pundits and consumers, Apple got rid of the headphone jack in the iPhone, which is a big deal.
I mean, this is one of those things, like, are we nitpicking or is this a big deal? You're the expert. What are we doing here?
We are doing a little bit of both. I mean, the headphone jack is the most widely used audio technology in the world. Every device just about has one. There are a couple of new phones that have come out that have gotten rid of it. So Apple is not the first to do this, to sort of try to push the industry in the direction of wireless headphones, Bluetooth headphones, and thinner designs. What getting rid of this headphone jack will allow for in the future is thinner phones. And so Apple is trying to make the argument that we are all eventually going to move to wireless headphones, and they're just accelerating what is a natural process.
So they're making these little things that look to me like part of your earbuds with a Q-tip. What's the point of those?
So, yeah, there are a couple of options now with the new phone. When you buy the new phone, now Apple at least does realize that people like me, for example, I use headphones, a headset, to talk on the phone all day, every day. That's what I primarily use headphones for. So the headphone jack for me as a consumer is one of the parts of the phone that I actually use the most often. And I'm not alone. Anybody who is on the phone a lot often uses their iPhone in this way. So Apple recognized that there would be some pushback. And in a very unusual move, they're including an adapter in the box so that if you have a favorite pair of headphones, you can plug it in using this adapter. They'll also include their own new headphones that plug into basically the same port that you use to charge the phone. The Lightning connector is what it's called. Mm-hmm. But they have also invented this whole new set of wireless headphones that they're calling AirPods that are $159. There is no wire whatsoever. They're basically, like you said, they look like a sort of Q-tip fish hook. And they just rest gently in your ears and magically play music or audio.
So I guess the big question behind all of this is why? And we have some sound from an Apple executive at the event. Tell us who this is and then let's play it.
Yeah, this is Apple Senior Vice President Phil Schiller appearing to address what was a lot of outcry about this issue before the announcement.
Well, the reason to move on, I'm going to give you three of them, but it really comes down to one word, courage. The courage to move on, do something new that betters all of us. And our team has tremendous courage.
I am sorry, but this is a multi-billion dollar company. Maybe I'm just a deep cynic, but courage? Really, Molly? What's the real why here?
Well, it does start with C. It's cash. The real why is, I mean, Apple, look, Apple makes a ton of money on accessories. It has made a ton of money on its proprietary charging cables, those Lightning cables that I was just talking about. It's going to make a lot of money, probably, or it hopes to make a lot of money selling these $160 wireless earbuds. It will sell more and more and more headphones with the Lightning connector. It will be able to partner with accessories makers. Certainly, there is some technological march forward. But to be honest, I think it was that line that turned off a segment that might have otherwise been convinced. It just feels like such an overreach. And frankly, Lizzie, it comes at a time when Apple is vulnerable. It is selling fewer phones.
You mentioned cash a couple of times in this conversation. On a sort of a meta level, Apple as a company has a tremendous amount of cash. They've been criticized for that. But one thing I'm curious about is, like, what are they doing with that? Because, okay, new phones, the Lightning port, some updates to the watch. But what about all that money they're sitting on? What are they doing with that that we aren't seeing yet?
Yeah, it's so interesting because on the one hand, having $200 billion and change in the bank is what allows you to take a major risk with your flagship device. It allows you to make this really controversial move, knowing that if sales aren't that great this time, you've got a new one coming next year and you can absorb any losses. But the real question is what is happening behind the scenes, because you would think that that $200 billion in change would let them make even bigger risks. And that's what we are still waiting to see. We know that Apple is still filing patents. They're acquiring companies. They're rumored to be experimenting with building an electric car. But so far, we've seen nothing come out of that. And it's getting to the point where it's a little bit surprising. And there are real questions about where the company is going to go, because it starts to look like they're kind of at a loss.
You know, one thing that has occurred to me as we were getting ready to have this conversation is we're talking about one company. And that's kind of amazing to me that this one company has this dog and pony show every year and we pay so much attention to it. Why does Apple have such an outsized role in both our economy and, I guess, our popular imagination of the economy?
And that's really it. I mean, Apple has empirically an outsized role in our economy in that they are, you know, among the top five largest companies in the world. So that gives them sort of automatic influence. But it really is this sort of triumph of consumer branding. It's just been an unstoppable force in terms of marketing. It is the kind of company that makes you want to, has made you want to be part of its brand. You want to own Apple products because it makes you feel better. You're an Apple person. You identify with it and create some identity around being part of this brand. And that's something that, like, every brand aspires to, and very few have. The question is whether Apple can sort of continue to bank on that, continue to bet on the power of the brand being strong enough that consumers will forgive things like losing the headphone jack. And look, they have before. This is not the first time that Apple has forced people off of some sort of beloved standard and onto something else. It just feels like it comes at a little more dangerous time right now.
Marketplace's Molly Wood, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
This year, we've talked a lot about policing and the criminal justice system. and all the complicated and thorny issues surrounding them. One issue is how people with disabilities fare. A huge number of people in jails and prisons in the U.S. have some sort of disability, anywhere between 30% and 50%, depending on how you count. Most have mental or cognitive disabilities. Advocates say it amounts to an expensive and ineffective way to treat behavioral health. And there are other costs, like people with disabilities killed in police custody. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has this story from Detroit.
All his life, Kevin Matthews loved gifts. Not getting them, giving them.
My birthday, Mother's Day, Christmas was very, very special to him.
This is his mom, Valerie Johnson. One year for her birthday, Kevin got her a pair of pink running shoes, pink leggings, and a pink crown to wear to the party.
And I said, I'm not going to wear that for my birthday. He said, that's what I bought it for, you to wear for your birthday. So I put it on, and boy, it made him so happy. He had the biggest smile on his face.
Kevin lived with his mom on the northwest edge of Detroit. When he was 11, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. This is his older sister, Kim Matthews.
From the day he was born, as he started growing up and we saw something was wrong, we extra loved him hard. We gave him extra attention, extra love.
As an adult, she says he liked to wander the streets, talking to people. And that's how police usually came into contact with him.
It was mainly because of his illness that he did get in trouble here and there.
He went to jail a few times, small stuff related to alcohol, a couple dropped charges. She says he wasn't worried about time in jail.
He'd be like, oh, it's okay, you know, I'm gonna be all right. I met these people, they're really nice.
But his family always worried something would happen. Even at age 35, he was vulnerable, easy to take advantage of. And then something did happen. Last December, his mom was waiting for him to come home around noon. She called Kevin's girlfriend, who was just around the corner.
I said, what you doing around the corner? She says, it's a guy around here just got killed. And then I felt it.
Valerie Johnson's gut feeling was right. Just around the corner on the border of Detroit and the suburb of Dearborn, her son was laying out on the street. Kevin Matthews had been shot at least 6 times by a Dearborn police officer. The family says they stood behind a police barricade all day, but nobody talked to them. They still hardly know anything about what happened. In a press release later, police said they were pursuing Kevin on a suspected larceny. After a struggle of some kind, police said an officer, still unnamed, discharged his weapon, and they said Kevin was unarmed. Ron Haddad, the Dearborn police chief, added in an interview that officers in his department knew Kevin. They knew his face and where he lived.
I am very confident that not only him, but most people we come in contact with, we treat in a very civil manner, but particularly Kevin Matthews. He was treated very civilly on more than one occasion by members of our department.
Sometimes Kevin would do things like go to sleep on the street. Haddad says at least once officers gave him a ride home. He calls Kevin's death regrettable, especially since the department has been working on de-escalation.
I'm very proud of what we've done here over the last 8 years because our use of force has dropped down over 90%.
Haddad says the majority of people his department sees are either mentally disabled or dealing with a substance problem. Kevin's family says he was usually on medication, but when he had an episode, there was nowhere to go, no one to call. And that's common, partly because of long-term cuts to behavioral health services around the country. Michigan alone cut tens of millions from mental health from 2009 to 2012.
The shortage in the clinicians, as well as the cuts in funding, result in really, really high caseloads.
Carmen McIntyre is with the Detroit Wayne County Mental Health Authority. She says wait times can be long, say if you just want to talk to a therapist. So it's easy for people like Kevin to fall through the cracks.
And they're ending up then in jails, which is not appropriate.
Right now, it's impossible to track just how many victims of police violence are disabled. But Lawrence Carter Long, a disability activist, co-authored a study of media reports and estimated the number is between a half and two-thirds. He says disability itself is being criminalized.
If you tell a person who's autistic to freeze or stop, and maybe they're overstimulated at that moment, you're basically asking them to not be autistic. You're asking them not to be disabled, which is really impossible.
Kevin Matthews' relatives have organized several protests. His mom has been too overwhelmed to work, and Kim says she cries every day. But it's his little brother, Lavelle, who is the shakiest.
He was the middle sibling. He kept us together because we all felt like we had a job to do, which was keep him close, keep him grounded.
Lavelle says he's had a hard time in the past, but for the last 5 years, he's had a steady job, tried to be a good parent to his twin kids, motivated by the fact that Kevin saw him, his younger brother, as a role model.
Everything I stood for, everything I was living for, everything that I've been working so hard for to show him and be a better example to him because he looked up to me, is lost. And I can't get it back.
Kevin Matthews' death is under investigation by the Wayne County prosecutor. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
It's time for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we bring in well-known people, musicians, writers, artists, and ask them questions about work and money and how those things have shaped their lives. Here's Marketplace producer Haley Hirschman with this week's guest.
My name is Roxanne Gay. I'm the author of An Untamed State and Bad Feminist and forthcoming Difficult Women and Hunger.
In a next life, what would your career be?
In my next life, my career, kept woman. My next career would be an emergency room physician. I've always wanted to be a doctor, and I just love the idea of working with a lot of different kinds of patients and meeting a lot of different kinds of people. You know you'll never get bored working in an ER.
What is the hardest part about your job that nobody knows?
The hardest part about my job is having to go on television and having to do a lot of public events. I'm a writer because I don't like people. I'm a writer because I'm shy. I want to be behind the scenes. And I didn't realize that when a book takes off, you have to go in front of cameras. So that's the hardest part.
Has it been getting any easier?
Mm-mm. No. It has not necessarily been getting easier, but I am getting more used to it.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
Oh, the iPad Pro. I never use it, and it really is very, very big. And that's what she said. And it's just so large. And when I'm holding it, it barely fits in my hands. True story. It's not practical. I mean, sometimes you just need something to be just a normal size.
When did you realize that writing could be an actual career?
Oh, I don't know, but I'll let you know when I do find that out. I think in the past 5 years. I mean, I've always known it can be an actual career, but it was really, I think, about 5 years ago when I was 36 that I realized that you can cobble together a reasonably good life as a writer.
Do you remember the first time you got paid to write?
The first time I got paid to write was for an erotica anthology when I was in my 20s, and they paid $50. Now I just take those same stories and publish them in literary magazines.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started writing?
I wish I had been given advice on how to handle criticism and the kinds of, you know, when to respond, when not to respond, how to take the best of the criticism, and, you know, how to discard those things that aren't really going to make you into a better writer. You know, just advice on how to handle criticism.
How do you think you handled criticism when you first started?
Not very well. I handle it the same way now. Monkey, you are trash and you don't deserve to exist. Now, when I first started out, I took it really personally, of course, because writing is oftentimes personal. And the deeper I've gone into my career, I still take it personally, but I have learned and I continue to learn how to really hear what's valuable in that criticism so that I can become a better writer and thinker. And I've also learned which pieces of criticism are not so much about me, but about the person who wrote the criticism, and knowing when to just make that distinction and ignore what that person has to say.
Do you think that you're pretty good at giving criticism?
I'm very good at it. No, I teach, and I teach creative writing, and so you have to learn how to give criticism, and I do think I do it well, because with a background in teaching, I try to remember anyway, that you want to make someone better. You don't want to tear them down, and so I try to be supportive while also being very frank, because I don't think it's bad to hold someone's hand, but I do think it's bad when you make them think that they are perfect or that they can't improve, or when you sugarcoat criticism. And so I try to be frank, but also kind.
Look out for Roxanne's new book, Difficult Women, in January. Now that we are back from Labor Day, it's time for a lot of us to go back to school, back to work, back to more regular life. This can also be a time of thinking, okay, this year, this fall, I'm going to change some habits, do better, etc., etc. So we wanted to give you some tools to make your life a little more productive and efficient. We are revisiting our conversation with New York Times journalist Charles Duhigg and the lessons in his book, Smarter, Faster, Better. We spoke to him earlier this year. Charles Duhigg, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to start on an airplane. In 2010, a flight from Singapore to Sydney.
Yes, Singapore to Sydney.
Singapore to Sydney. And essentially, everything goes wrong. Multiple
terribly
engine
wrong.
Problems, et cetera. This is Qantas Flight 32. And the captain on this flight, Richard de Crepigny, does a bunch of things right, and I want you to tell me what they are.
It's exactly right. It's a fascinating story because this is one of the worst mid-air mechanical failures ever. One of the blades on the turbine in the jet engine shears off and shoots through the wing, and it actually creates a hole as big as a man's body.
Mm.
And as it explodes, it creates a shrapnel that cuts through like electrical lines and fuel lines. Basically, almost every single major system in the plane all of a sudden stops working.
I covered aviation before I came to Marketplace, and one of the things I noticed here is that he's calling out commands, and some of the other officers on the plane say no. And that's remarkable in aviation, and we're going to get into why this is important in business and work. But what happened?
Well, so what's really interesting about this particular flight is – and you know this as a former aviation reporter – is that this particular crew had been really well trained in what's known as situational awareness, right? And we find that actually very productive people, they all have this tendency, which is that they tell themselves stories about what's going on in their lives all the time. They build these mental models. And Richard de Crepigny, before they had actually gotten on the plane, he was taking his crew and he was saying, look – if this goes wrong, what are you going to do first? Like, where do your eyes go? Where do your hands go? He was taking them through scenarios and saying, let's start telling ourselves a story about what's going to happen if there's an accident. But the thing is about this accident is that it's so overwhelming, it's so devastating that everybody doesn't know what to do at first. They become almost overwhelmed by this flow of emergency warnings and commands from the computer that tells them fix this or respond to that problem. And it becomes a situation where even though they're very well prepared for this, they're so overwhelmed that they almost can't function. And that's when Richard de Crepigny makes this very critical shift in his thinking.
Which is?
So what he does is he actually takes his hands off the control panel and he closes his eyes. Now keep in mind, this is a plane that's mid-air. Basically everything is failing. It's got a huge hole in the wing. People can see the hole in the wing out the windows.
And more than 400 people are on board.
More than 400 people are on board, and they're basically sort of cruising through and they almost can't control the plane. And what Richard de Crespigny does is he takes his hands off the controls. He closes his eyes and he says to himself, I need to start telling myself a different story about this plane. I can't think of it as an Airbus A380 anymore. Instead, what I need to do is I need to think of it as a Cessna. Now, a Cessna, for anyone who's flown, as you know, it's almost like a toy plane, right? It's what hobbyists use or people learn to fly on. It's this small, incredibly simple airplane. An Airbus, the A380, is this huge, complex piece of machinery. But Richard de Crespigny says, I need to imagine this plane as a Cessna, because in a Cessna, all that you have to focus on is essentially a couple of things: your wheels, your trim, your rudder. And what he needed to do is he needed to eliminate distractions and focus what was on the important things. But when you're in the middle of an emergency, it's so easy to get overwhelmed by all that information. So he starts telling himself a new story about a Cessna. And as a result, he's able to land this plane safely because he knows what to focus on and what to ignore.
My life, your life, not as complicated as someone with several hundred people depending on them. Why is this anecdote important in terms of understanding how to be, I don't know, better at your sales job?
Well, it's because even though we think of our lives as not being that complex, it maybe isn't quite as dangerous, but our lives are complex, right? I mean, think about what all the things that you're exposed to in an average day. You're getting all these emails all the time, right? And your phone is vibrating in your pocket. And then you go into a meeting and you're trying to think about what you want to say next when suddenly your boss asks you an unexpected question and you have to respond to them. And at the same time, there's some emergency email coming over. Right? Our lives are incredibly complex, and they are only getting more complex as technology and the economy drives us to be faster and to try and deal with more information. And so the question then becomes, how do the most productive companies and people, how do they deal with all this information overload?
So you've sketched out a couple of different principles that allow companies and people to do that. What are they?
Well, the number one thing is that the best people act like de Crespigny. They think to themselves, what story should I be telling myself about my day, about myself? How do I build a mental model that allows me to pay attention to the things that matter and ignore the distractions that I don't have to focus on right now? Now, it turns out that our brain is actually pretty bad on its own at figuring out how to make sense of a huge amount of information coming in, unless we have some structure to put it in, unless we have a story that we're telling ourselves where we're anticipating what are the things that we expect to have happen and we're primed to respond to those, and what's unexpected, which means we might be able to ignore those things or at least put them aside and say, I don't have to react right away. Instead, I'm going to give myself a moment to process it and think about what's going on. So when your boss asks you that question unexpectedly in the middle of the meeting and you've got five things on your brain, instead of splurting out some answer that might be the wrong thing to say, you can say, look, the story in my head, it doesn't anticipate this question. So I'm going to give myself a couple of beats before I answer because I really need to think about what I'm going to say.
That comes up under a chapter called Focus, and I'm going to flip back to one called Teams, which also struck me as very important in just about anybody's workaday life. The ingredients that make a successful team, they were not what I thought they would be before I read this book. The thing that comes up over and over again is psychological safety. What is that? And how is that important in, you know, a meeting in your office?
I love this chapter. And in fact, I love the fact that its roots are in a study that Google did that took 4 years and millions of dollars to try and figure out how to build the perfect team. And when they went into this, what they said is exactly what you just said, that teams are really important now. And building the perfect team is probably a matter of like taking the best people and putting them together, right? That like maybe you need introverts and extroverts. Turns out that's totally wrong. The who is on a team matters much, much less than how the team interacts. And at the core of this is exactly what you said, this idea called psychological safety. Teams become most effective when people feel like they are safe to say things among each other without recriminations. And the way that you create psychological safety, according to all these studies, is two things. First of all, you need to have equality in conversational turn-taking, or basically everyone on the team needs to feel like they can pipe up and say what they want to say. But that on itself isn't enough. You also have to have what's called high average social sensitivity, which means that if I see that you're crossing your arms and you're kind of upset, that I say to you, Lizzie, what's going on? Like, why aren't you talking up? Or if you look really excited, that I pick up on that and I say, hey, Lizzie, it looks like you're really enthusiastic about this idea, that I'm showing you that I'm actually listening to you. If you have a team, as long as people feel like they can say whatever they want to and that other people are actually showing that they're listening, then it doesn't matter if you like each other or you play Frisbee together or if you have nothing in common. That team is much more likely to be successful because that psychological safety makes me feel like I can bring my whole self to work.
Yet that does seem like it would be sort of contradictory to the faster part of of this title, because if everybody gets to talk in the meeting, that's going to be a long meeting.
Well, that's the thing that we find about productivity, particularly the science of productivity, is that much of what actually makes us productive, on the face of it, doesn't seem efficient. Right? You're exactly right. It would be much easier to walk into a meeting and say, Jim's the expert. Let's all do what Jim says. Similarly, it'd be much faster to have a captain who says, look, I'm not going to think about all these different scenarios. I'm just going to deal with problems as they arise. But what we know is that particularly in today's economy and with this technology that's emerging, oftentimes being busy and being productive are actually at odds with each other. Doing what seems efficient isn't the same thing as making decisions and choices that allow us to be more productive.
I look at this book, your previous book, The Power of Habit. I feel like there are a lot of books out there that are sort of about this collision of psychology, work, economics. Why do you think we are so interested as a society in this stuff right now?
I think we're living through an economic and cultural revolution that most economists at this point agree is as profound as the agrarian revolution and the industrial revolution. And when that happens, there is anxiety, right?
Although not all of us equally.
Not all of us equally. And the fact that things are changing, particularly in ways that we don't totally understand, that causes anxiousness. And so the question then becomes, so how can I take advantage of what we know to prepare myself? And we're lucky in that at the same time that this revolution is occurring, we're also living through a golden age of understanding neurology, right? We're understanding things about the brain. We're understanding things about organizational psychology that we never knew before. Behavioral economics has opened up this whole new field. And so we actually have these new tools to understand why people behave the ways that they do, how they can behave better. And so we're looking as a society, as a humanity, for answers. Why is it that although I now have email and all these devices and I can work from anywhere, why do I feel so busy and overwhelmed all the time? And the answer is because we oftentimes mistake busyness for productivity, but we're beginning to learn how to moderate the information and the inputs and how to take control of our brains in a way that let us become the people that we want to be.
Well, what is true productivity?
I think productivity differs from person to person and place to place, right? So for you, productivity in the morning might be getting through all of your emails. But on the weekend, it might be, you know, being able to straighten the house and have a nice relaxing brunch. For someone with kids, it might mean getting home in time to have dinner. For someone who's not married yet, it might mean being able to like look at three or four potential spouses in a week, right? It differs from person to person and time and place to place. But what's important is that what we know is that when people become more proactive instead of reactive, when they understand how their brain functions better and can take control of how they're thinking and what they're doing, then however they define productivity, it's within closer reach.
What are the biggest mistakes that companies and people make when trying to be more productive?
I think the biggest mistakes that people make is that they become purely reactive, right? They start mistaking this busyness for productivity. They say that if you get to inbox zero, then you must be really productive. But we all know people who respond to emails right away and they end up wasting a huge amount of time because half those emails don't need responses, or they train their colleagues to send them questions that they could have answered on their own. It's really about stopping and deciding, what are my actual goals? What do I want? How do I arrange those goals in my life? How do I manage my focus? How do I self-motivate in a way that I can get what I think I most need and is most useful out of each day, rather than simply reacting to all these demands and inputs around me?
How have you changed your own life? Come on, you wrote it says smarter, better, faster. Are you?
I think I am. I think so this book actually began because I had written The Power of Habit and it had just come out, and I was working on a series at the New York Times about Apple. And like I was more professionally successful than I'd ever been before, and I was miserable. I just felt like – I felt like I was just running like a chicken with its head cut off all the time. And I felt like I was missing opportunity after opportunity. And I talked to people who, just like me, they only had 24 hours in their day, but they were more successful than me, and they also seemed calmer. They seemed like they were just on top of things more. They got more done. And I thought to myself, there must be some secret there that I'm missing. And when I started doing the research, I learned that that's exactly right. The most productive people and companies, they think differently. They are much more deliberate about making choices that the rest of us hardly even recognize exist as decisions in the first place. And so one of the things that I've done is I've completely reformed how, for instance, I set goals or how I write to-do lists. It's completely changed how I think about my day and the stories I tell myself when I'm on the subway on the way to work to sharpen my focus. When I need to be creative, I manage the creative process completely differently because I've learned that there are these companies and these individuals who understand how to manage their own thinking much better. And inevitably, that leads to them getting more done. They waste less time. And it's actually I'll have to say it as a cynical reporter, it's actually transformed my life to be able to see things.
Give me an example.
Well, so one of the great examples is my wife and I struggled for a long time to have dinner every night with our kids. Like we knew that we should have dinner with them and like we always made it home late. And so when I was learning about agile methodologies and the Toyota production system, they introduced me to this idea called the five whys. And this is actually how Toyota makes lean factories, is if you have a problem, you identify the problem and you ask why five times and you get to a root cause. And so we said, okay, we keep on missing – we get home too late to have dinner with our kids. So let's use the five whys. So why are we getting home late? Well, it turns out that we always have like – we intend to leave the office at 5:30, but we've got all this stuff to do at the end of the day. So why do we have all this stuff to do at the end of the day? Well, usually it's because we're in meetings all day long. So why are we in meetings all day long? Well, it's because we inevitably get to work at like 9:30 right before the first meeting begins. So we never get a chance to like catch up on our email. So why are we getting to the office at 9:30 instead of earlier? Well, it's because we always want to leave the house at 8, but our kids aren't dressed. And so it takes forever to get them dressed. And then they're late for school and we're running late. And why aren't our kids dressed earlier in the morning? It's because they wake up and then they go and they watch TV. And then we have to harass them to go get dressed. So it turns out the reason we're not having dinner together as a family is because our kids aren't getting dressed early enough in the morning. So what's the solution to that? Well, we tell them that they have to lay out their clothes every night before they go to sleep and get dressed as soon as they wake up. If you had asked me how I solved the problem of us having family dinner, it never would have occurred to me that it has to do with how my kids get dressed in the morning. But once you begin to understand how to see the world as a series of systems, as things that you can analyze and break down, now we have dinner together on a regular basis.
Charles Duhigg, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, the history of the $2 bill. And we'll be hearing your stories about money and education. Are you spending on yourself? On your kids? What have you learned or figured out? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.